And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out. I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
Gonna put one foot in front of the other foot.
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on. Got to keep on going.
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
When my grandma...
Hi there. I'm Jeff Browning, and welcome to Benders of the Arc podcast, where we interview movers and shakers for social change.
This episode of our podcast is a recording of a webinar that the Presbyterian Peace Fellowship produced in March of 2022. As many of you may know, the Presbyterian Peace Fellowship began in the 1940s, supporting conscientious objectors to World War II. PPF has been advocating for the abolition of war and violence for almost 80 years through accompaniment programs and training, through gun violence prevention, and most recently, through a small but growing contingent of churches that have declared themselves to be peace churches. Churches that believe that all war and violence is inconsistent with the gospel of Christ. And yet, in times of war, especially when we see the suffering and death of innocent people, we are tempted to carve out exceptions to the use of war and violence. Nonviolence is often interpreted as passivity in the face of violence. How do we avoid the saccharine solution of thoughts and prayers in times like this? These are difficult questions, to be sure. So I would encourage each of us to approach this conversation with grace. None of us has all the answers, but we are seeking clarity and understanding while being faithful followers of the Prince of Peace. That is why we have two wonderful people with us today to help us get this conversation started. Our guests today are the Reverend Deborah Lee and Rick Ufford-Chase. Deborah Lee is director of the Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity, dedicated to immigrant justice and ending the criminalization of people of color. A founding member of Women for Genuine Security, the U.S. partners in International Women's Network Against Militarism, which seeks to hold the U.S. government accountable for the violence, sexual exploitation, economic and environmental effects of U.S. militarism in the many countries which host U.S. bases. She is also an ordained minister in the United Church of Christ. Rick lives on traditionally Abenaki lands in northern Vermont. Among the number of hats that Rick wears, he is a co-founder and co-director with the Reverend Ashley Detart-Burt of the Center for Jubilee Practice, an organization dedicated to moving religious communities in the United States to take concrete acts of healing, repair, and reparations, particularly in response to enduring systemic injustice perpetrated with the blessing or in the name of Christianity. Rick has been a lifelong peace activist committed to nonviolent direct action and accompaniment to those whose lives have been turned upside down by war. And we should also note that Rick was moderator of the Presbyterian Church USA from 2004 to 2006. And in good Presbyterian fashion, we begin a conversation with prayer. Please pray with me. Over and over again, the scriptures tell us to fear not, be of good courage, be not afraid. And yet, we confess, O God, we are afraid. We are afraid and pray for women, children, and all those fleeing the violence of war in Ukraine. We are afraid, and pray for those who are left behind and cannot flee. We are afraid for those not only in Ukraine, but in war zones around the world where the world is not watching. Yemen, Afghanistan, Syria, Colombia, and others. We are afraid for the future, because once a war begins, no one can be sure how it will end. Unleash in us and all your people, citizens and diplomats alike, your prophetic imagination, the ability to see a way where there is no way. Ignite within us the creative imagination to find a way through this valley of the shadow of death and destruction, to your promised land of justice and peace for all people, near and far. May this be manifest today for all those in war zones around the world, and may this be manifest for us today, right here, as we hold them in our hearts. In the name of the Prince of Peace, amen. Rick and Deb, it's so wonderful to have you here. Welcome.
A couple of questions to get us started. You'll each have 4 minutes to respond. So, and we can start with Rick. Rick, how do we advocate for peace in a time of war? And what does it mean to be a follower of the Prince of Peace at times like this?
Well, thank you, Jeff. It's wonderful to be with all of you. I'm humbled by the group that's assembled. I know many of you. In fact, there are a number of you in the space with us tonight that I would turn to normally for my own counsel as I seek a way through these challenging times and try and determine where I should stand. I think what I want to say before I say anything else is that I am humbled every time a new military aggression breaks out by the fact that my immediate reaction that it's an involuntary reflex in me that I suspect has been trained into me from birth, that there probably is no other way to deal with this than with violence. And somehow, in spite of a lifetime of committed peace activism, I find myself in that position over and over again. And mostly what I've learned in those moments is that I need to be quiet, slow down, reach out to the people who are wiser than I am and who help me remember that, in fact, I can't think of a conflict, certainly not a conflict in my lifetime, that has gotten better because of a military response. So I just want to start with that because I suspect I'm not the only one who finds myself in that dilemma. So how do we advocate for peace? Well, I just want to note a few things, and I may not get to the heart of your question, but I think it's where I want to try and start, Jeff. First thing I want to say is that I was on a call today with a group of folks doing a Zoom course together through Johnson C. Smith Theological Seminary, a group of almost entirely African-American learning partners. We don't call them students. And as we gathered prayers at the beginning of our course this afternoon, several of the learning partners were reflecting on Dr. King's speech in Memphis and his speech at Riverside Church, which is now, 54 years ago, calling out the triple threats, and in particular, going after the Vietnam War. And they were saying, you know, you can take out the words Vietnam and insert the word Ukraine, and everything else is exactly the same from the time that King made those speeches 50 years ago to where we are today. So I just want to note that in that particular circle, among a group of entirely Black, theologically minded, activist minded folks who care about social justice, they were simply recognizing that the systemic injustices that we confront are as significant as they've ever been. And I guess that takes me to the next thing that I want to offer, which is a kind of a personal musing about the reality that our world seems to be tilting toward lunatic dictators, strongmen, and fascist leaders. And I find myself, ironically, over the last 6 months, thinking more and more about what fascism might look like if I have to live under it. I've honestly never thought that before in my life until recently. I spent a month and a half this winter thoughtfully and slowly reading Isabel Allende's novel, The Long Petal of the Sea, that I highly recommend to all of you because it's a fictionalized but true account based on a true story of a man that Allende tracks through his involvement in the Spanish Civil War, fighting fascism for the Republic in Spain, and then fleeing Spain to France, and then ending up on a ship that Pablo Neruda chartered for 2,000 Spanish refugees to be taken to Chile, rebuilding his life, and then fleeing once again when the U.S.-backed coup against Allende took place, and Allende was killed and Pinochet took power, and he had to flee again to Venezuela, where he lived until Pinochet died, and he was finally able to return to Chile to complete the rest of his life. I guess I just want to mention that because I don't think that Putin is the end of this story. I think we run as much risk here in the United States as people, maybe not as much in this moment, but I think the risks long-term here in the United States of fascism are as significant here as they are there. And these are not the only two places in the world where that risk is real. So I guess I want to start us off by saying that for me, advocating for peace means a confession, first and foremost, that this is not a faraway problem. This is something that is up close and personal. And I'll just, I'll finish by saying that I heard an interview and I should be able to cite it completely. And I apologize that I can't. I heard a podcast on Vox Conversations about a month ago where a professor from Yale University was being interviewed. And what really stopped me in my tracks was he said, you know, most people think of fascism as an ideology and they're wrong. It's not an ideology. And I thought, well, that's exactly what I thought it was. And he said, no, fascism is an occurrence and you can predict exactly when it will occur. It takes place by and large when democracies have allowed structural injustice to get to the point where they can't function any longer. And the country then begins to slide into this direction. So I just want to bring a level of kind of humility to this conversation. For me, this is not a conversation about just about Putin and what Putin is doing that is outrageous and ludicrous in Ukraine, but also about a similar risk that we run here and structural injustice that means violence in the lives of people that I know and love on a daily basis here in our own country. So I'll try and come back, Jeff, later when I have more opportunity to talk more specifically about some of those things that I think we can do. But I wanted to preface that with this conversation with these kind of more significant ruminations that have been going on in my own head for months now. And Deb, I'd welcome your thoughts on this because we haven't talked and I'm anxious to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Rick. Deb, please.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you all for gathering today and taking time for this reflection that hopefully we can all learn from each other and discern together what we should be doing. I share that reflection, Rick, in terms of I was sensing my own feeling of vulnerability at like, oh, my life and the life of our planet is, you know, whether through nuclear war or climate catastrophe caused by more militarism, is like in the hands of dangerous men. Mm-hmm. You know, a few dangerous men in the world. And it's a scary thought. And I think, you know, coming from the International Women's Network Against Militarism, I just want to emphasize the important linkage we make between patriarchy and militarism. And so if we really want to end war and militarism, we have to address patriarchy in the ways that that shows up at every level of society and is manifest in the worst ways through dictators and authoritarian rulers, which we just have come through a period of having that ourselves in this country in a way and feeling that sense of it. So I just want to name that because I think it's not going to change if the patriarchy isn't addressed. And certainly it could be women in power who possess the same kind of perception of power and power over that could lead us to the same situations. But I think that's something to name. So this question of how do we advocate for peace and nonviolence in a time of war, I was thinking, well, how are we advocating for peace and nonviolence when it wasn't a time of war? And is it different? I mean, it certainly feels harder because the media and the framing of what we're seeing is being painted in really stark ways of like good and evil, you know, the dictators and the heroes, you know. And I think that whenever things get painted in such stark ways for us, and kind of you feel like you have to buy into that framework or what, you know, you're with the other side, you know, it feels like the gap, the space to maneuver, the space to articulate has gotten much narrower. So it certainly feels harder. And I can address that. I can agree with that, but I feel like, what were we doing before? Like when it wasn't a time of war, this current war, you know, we were really in a time of the constant preparedness for war. We were already in a time of war, you know, as you mentioned, Jeff, the other places that are in war right now and other parts of the globe that are off the news cycle right now. And I think in the United States, as us, the largest, you know, military in the world, like we have been in a constant state of war. And I think over and over again of like, did we do everything we could do to prevent this current invasion? Did we put everything on the table? Did we put our hearts out as a country, the diplomats in our country, to prevent this from happening? And I just don't think we did. Our organization works a lot with refugees, asylum seekers, immigrants. You know, most of the world's people, displaced people, don't have refugee status and are really, really vulnerable. We try to help one family at a time. It's an incredible amount of work. And sometimes, you know, the rules are against people. But I just, on my heart this week was just thinking, if we really care about refugees, we would do everything we could to prevent war, to prevent displacement, from prevent this, because we're talking in the millions and millions and millions. And my organization tries to help, you know, tens, maybe hundreds of people. And it's a teaspoon in the bucket. So I think that one thing that we need to remind ourselves as people who are against war is like to ground ourselves in our values of like, why did we take this position in the first place? Like, what are our values of not engaging in violence, of preventing suffering in any way that we can, of not allowing the dehumanization of any person and of the many? Like, we have to continue to ground ourselves because all those machinations are at work. Whenever there's a war, when it's like starts to paint a very black and white picture of things. And I'll just end here and then we can go on to another question, but like, how do we have to, this automatic default to military response, it's a trauma pathway. You know, it's a trauma pathway for this country, the beginning of our country. It's a trauma pathway for our own lives. How many, if you can think about your own life, which wars have impacted your life and your family's life? It's a trauma pathway to think that's the only thing we can do. And how do we retrain ourselves as a species to really identify other pathways that we know? Because we already know that that trauma pathway creates more trauma, creates more suffering, creates more violence, creates more death. Anytime you send more rockets and missiles and military equipment, it's going to be more death on somebody. And so I'll just stop there for now.
Many of us support the use of nonviolence, but only to a point. And many would say that Russia's unprovoked attack on Ukraine, or perhaps the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center, is beyond the pale. And we must therefore fight fire with fire. But I guess my question is, if we say that we believe in nonviolence, but resort to violence when we think the situation calls for it, are we really committed to nonviolence?
You want to go first, Deb, or you want me to jump in on this one? Well, I mean, the short answer is no, we're not. And this is the task, I think, for those of us who profess nonviolence as a part of our deepest held conviction, particularly faith conviction. And I count myself in this group, that I recognize in me the impulse toward violence that rises up in my personal life or in my communal life. And it takes hard work to push back against that. You know, I get frustrated every time we find ourselves at this moment, because there are many of us, particularly in the organization of the Presbyterian Peace Fellowship, so many folks are here from that organization tonight, who insist in the in-between war spaces, if there is such a thing anymore, that we should be building the nonviolent strategies that will continue to allow peaceful interactions between people. And you know, so let's just talk about what's really underlying this, right? Part of what's underlying this, the best article I've read so far on this to date is an article by Bill McKibben that in which McKibben says, hey, you know, what's really going on here is that much of Europe is dependent on Russia for oil and gas, and therefore unwilling to actually do the hard work or take the hard stand against Russia. And what would it look like to try and break that? And McKibben's idea, I can source this for you, but if you just Google Bill McKibben's great idea about the war in Ukraine, you'll find it, is to invoke the War Powers Act here in the US and then to push into massive production of low energy heat pumps and give them or sell them at very low cost to Europeans and actually get them off the fossil fuel dependence that they have between now and next fall, so that when the cold weather rolls around next year, we actually have begun to solve this problem. And he notes that of course opens the door for solving those same problems in Minnesota and elsewhere, right? Like we as we do that, it pushes all of us. My wife noted this afternoon that she was in a salon getting her hair cut this afternoon, and one of the women in the salon was talking about how with the higher gas prices, perhaps it's time to think about an electric car. And so my wife, who owns an electric car, was having a conversation with her about that and what would it look like. And this woman, who may never have thought about it before, all of a sudden is willing to think about these things, right? So in the long run, we need to talk about what's really underlying this. I guess that's the first half. And the second half of the equation for me is what I learned. John Fife is on the phone tonight, Kara Bissell from the Borderlands, right? What we know from 40 years ago, supporting Central Americans in the midst of similarly violent, strong-arm dictatorships backed by the US government at that time, is that the only real response in those moments for grassroots faith-based organizations is to link up with other grassroots faith-based organizations in close personal relationship and to do what we could to be in solidarity with one another and to provide actual support, whether that support looked like providing resources for folks to try and live in the midst of what was functionally military occupation, or the support to try and get people whose lives were being threatened out of their countries and north across an unfriendly terrain in Mexico and across the US-Mexico border and into a network of safe churches in US and Canada. But we should be working at those personal relationships at all times, and especially in these moments, building those relationships up in Russia, in Ukraine, and in many other places where these conflicts are going on in the world.
Thanks, Rick. It's really helpful. Deb?
Yeah, I'll just, I think like looking at the underlying is really important. And I think that the economic and the energy, you know, how many wars have been around energy, you know, forms of energy, oil, fossil fuels, that's huge. I think that the other underlying issue is the issue of geopolitical dominance. And I think since the fall of the Soviet Union, the last 30 years, it's been the US geopolitical dominance. And we have to understand that the US's treaties, NATO, and many other treaties with many other countries, is about securing US dominance at all cost. And you know, in many parts of the world, we are the bullies. We are posturing as the bullies. And, you know, I think that other powerful nations like Russia and China, you know, we are headed we're headed to war, this war and other wars, unless we can change, alter the course of this competition for global dominance and power over into some kind of world where there's peaceful coexistence. And I want to just say that this competition for global dominance of nations often has nothing to do with the well-being of the people in those nations, the actual security of people in those nations, if people have health and education and housing and well-being. But all these things and posturing and more ramping up is all being done in the name of like, this is going to secure the nation, and it doesn't secure the people within the nation. And so I think we have to know, where do we stand? Do we stand with the nation, or do we stand with the people, you know, across nations?
Let's take a break here. And when we come back, we'll ask Deb to explain a little bit more about what she means by true security.
And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out, I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out,
gonna march on.
If you are new to our podcast, please visit our blog at bendersoftheark.com, where you can find more information about our stories and the people behind them. Now let's return to our guest.
Yeah, thank you, Deb. I remember you also spoke very well about the problem with security in that webinar that I thought was very powerful, because so often there's this conflict between, you know, they keep telling us that this is about security. So we buy more weapons, and we have more bases around the world, and it's all about security. So could you reflect on that a little bit more? Tell us a little bit more about that and what you were meeting it with that analogy.
Yeah, I think that it's like our notion of security has been kidnapped, you know, by the military, you know, by this military framework, you know, and they promise security. They say they are, you know, they are the only way. They actually say they're the only way to achieve security, right? Mm-hmm. And I think they've taken that away from us. And I think as Christians, we have to really think about, in our own framework, what does security mean? And the security, it's not just my security. My security is tied up with the security of my so-called enemy, right? So if my security means killing at the expense of other people, to me, that's not really security. So it's this idea of like, how do we define security on human terms? And if we actually do a historical analysis, as Rick mentioned, when has war and military conflict led to more security? In fact, it is today undermining security. It's undermining planetary security. It's undermining the security of Ukrainians and Russians. It's undermining in that whole region, actually. Military security doesn't solve the main problems that we have as a human species right now, but it is promising to, and it's sucking up all the resources that we could be using to achieve the kind of security that communities actually need. So I think that that's, and I want to just emphasize too, I want to name like what gets missed. And I think when we think of the cost of war, we think about like right now in like Ukrainians having to flee, their cities being bombed. But what gets invisibilized is the cost of war of diverted resources that have been diverted for decades. The cost of war of the 1,000 US bases and the communities who are forced to host those bases. There, my good friend Takazato Suzuyo in Okinawa, she said, you know, in response to Ukraine, She said, they're doing this to us too, but they're killing us slowly. We're not being killed by a bomb that drops today, but we're just being killed over time. Our water is being poisoned and people are dying of cancer and dying of other things. So the real cost of war and what they promise, they don't do what they say they promise. And I think that has to be questioned. It's a hard position to take, but we have to kind of question that and to be able to point to, you know, to an alternative.
And if I could just jump in there and push that in a slightly different direction to kind of add to it. It took my breath away when Putin a week and a half ago started threatening a use of a nuclear weapon, right? I mean, think about that. I'm 57 years old. I grew up with drills where we were told that we could duck our heads under a desk in a damned elementary school, right? And somehow protect ourselves. And all my life I've been taught that somehow nuclear weapons are supposed to actually create security in the world. And the Presbyterian Peace Fellowship was on the leading edge of that nuclear war movement in the 1980s that brought some semblance of sanity to our world. But my goodness, you know, here we are, what's it been, 30 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall, and no one's thought much about 4,500 nuclear weapons that Russia has in its control at this point, or how many nuclear weapons the United States has. And honestly, if we elect Trump again, I feel no more secure than I do about Putin, right? So let's just be clear that nuclear weapons are doing nothing. Any fantasy we had about deterrence as a foreign policy, if you have any vestige of that left in you, excise it, because it's ludicrous. It makes no sense whatsoever, right? So how do we talk about security, where security comes from, when we've got several generations that have been raised on this notion of security that comes not just at the point of a gun, but at the dropping of a nuclear weapon, right? And then you look at, take that one step further, you know, for the 12 years that I lived in the lower Hudson Valley, I worked along with a remarkable cadre of volunteers there trying to close down a defunct nuclear power plant that was still being allowed to operate years after its license to operate had expired by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, right? And it's sitting on five times the amount of spent fuel rods that it's actually designed for in the lower Hudson Valley. So let's talk about where security comes from, right? Anybody in a Cessna could do something that would threaten the entire New York metropolitan area. And somehow we act as if that's not a part of our conversation about security. And somehow nuclear energy is supposed to be clean energy that's going to resolve our addiction to fossil fuel, if you take that to its really silly conclusion. So when and how do we actually back away from these things that we have been carefully indoctrinated to believe actually provide us with some kind of a future, and insist that the things that actually make for a secure future our right relationship with one another that cross boundaries, right? And a breaking of the addiction to fossil fuel that we have been so dependent on, and living more simply and frankly, in the midst of these crazy moments, actually finding ways to say, I will provide safety for you. I mean, Deb, I really appreciate where you start that conversation too, right? Like actually 10 people in the midst of a war situation is a heroic effort anywhere it takes place. So those are the things that make for security, the things that build nurturing relationships among us.
Yeah. Thank you. So I guess you both have written or spoken in one way or another in previous presentations about flipping the script, or you know, how Jesus calls us and turns the whole message upside down, and how should we look at that now? Can that be do we take solace in that we're being called to approach this conflict and all conflicts in a different way? What is our perhaps our spiritual posture in relation to these concerns? Deb, would you like to go first?
Yeah, please go for that.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the late Thich Nhat Hanh and his work in the midst of the Vietnam War and his commitment to stop the violence and end all violence, and speaking to both sides of that war, and the commitment to have to say, you know, we have to prevent the loss of life. We have to prevent suffering. We have to, we can't stand for that, right? And to, and I think that I'm thinking about the founding of this organization, you know, of Conscientious Objectors in the time of World War II. That must have been a very difficult position for people to take at that time. And how I think as communities of faith, if we can get clear, if we can get more about our clarity about, this isn't just about peace. It's interesting. I had this conversation with someone at a congregation this weekend. She's like, yeah, she said, I don't advocate for peace anymore. I advocate for stopping all wars, because people can say I'm fighting war for peace. Right? They use that. This war, this, we're sending 13, is it million or billion? I can't, you know, to Ukraine, right? For peace, you know, but we know it's going to cause harm to somebody, you know, that we have to talk about stopping the violence and stopping all wars. And I am feeling sympathetic for our political leaders, even our allied democratic, you know, political leaders. I can imagine how narrow the space feels for them to advocate for something different. And I just think how important it is for them to hear from us as Christians who believe in an end to violence and believe that there should never be war, and that believe that there are other ways to go about this and solutions.
Yep, love that. I would add, I believe in action as a spiritually grounding exercise. I don't live much. I try not to live in my head. I don't care so much what people believe. I don't even really care so much at this point what churches say they believe, because it doesn't appear to make much difference in the dominant culture. I mean, you know, look at on the in the month or so leading up to the invasion of Iraq. Every single denomination, with the exception of the Southern Baptists and the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops, said to George Bush, this is outrageous. Don't do this. This is an aggression that will get us deep, deep into trouble. And he didn't care, because let's be honest, he knew us better than our leaders knew us, right? I mean, there's a poll that came out a couple of years later that said that 75% of Presbyterian pastors disagreed with the move to invade Iraq. And 75% of people in the pews in the Presbyterian Church thought it was the right thing to do. Now, there's a disconnect we could wrestle with for a little while, right? But it didn't really matter one way or the other, because George Bush thought, and he may have been right, he knew our parishioners better than we did. So it doesn't even really matter. I mean, do I want the Presbyterian Church USA or any other denomination to say, you know, Putin's aggression is wrong? Sure, I guess so. But I don't think it's going to make any real difference in the long run, one way or the other. What matters from my perspective is, what are we actually willing to do? So this might get to some of the questions I'm seeing coming up in the chat, right? My answer is, we begin looking now for the relationships, if we haven't done so already, in surrounding countries that are struggling to try and support what is now, I think, pushing 2.5 million people who have fled Ukraine. And we provide real support to them, because those folks are under serious pressure. And we look for ways to actually build alliances inside Russia with those groups that are saying no and are standing up and trying to push back against Putin. And if we can find those things, and I confess to you, I have yet to actually figure it out myself, but it's what I'm watching for, looking for. That seems to me to be the most spiritual exercise I can participate in. Real relationships with real people that actually make a difference to folks on the ground.
And that seems to be synergy with what you were describing earlier, Rick, and the accompaniment that both of you have done with immigrants and those that are struggling. And I think you've pointed out, Deb, that so many of the immigrants that come to our country are coming here because they're fleeing violence, often state violence or militia violence. Do you want to respond, Deb, to what we should do now for Ukraine? It's one of the questions.
Well, I think that there are some specifics, which I think someone's going to share, like some other specific organizations. I'd like your idea, Rick, of how do we build solidarity with others who are taking nonviolent action in other countries? I'm very curious, the voice of faith communities in other countries and faith leaders. Are they speaking out in the same? Are there others speaking out with a pacifist framework that we could help to elevate and speak up? I think that could be very powerful to look for. Yeah, those are some of the things I think that there's specific organizations people can support around Ukraine. And I want to just give perspective on the refugee situation, probably close to 2 million people who have left. I did come across a statistic that calculated the number of refugees caused by the US post 9/11 wars in a number of different countries. I can't recall all of them off the top of my head. And that number was 38 million refugees who were displaced by the US post 9/11 war. So just to put things into perspective and to, when we're condemning all invasions and all acts of war, that we remember that. And then another statistic was that, related to the Bill McKibben, point that there could be, 1 billion more refugees caused by the climate crisis alone by 2050. And knowing that militaries, military operations are like the greatest creators of greenhouse gases, and that, that is, fueling also creating this problem. And just one more other thought was just like, how do we really elevate like the enormous profit that is being created by war and decry that as a moral issue of moral conscience?
Yeah, so if I could just jump in there for a second. Earlier this week, knowing I was preparing for this conversation this evening, I sent out a note to about 7 or 8 friends in which the subject was a penny for your thoughts. And I said, I'm looking for what I should be talking about and thinking about myself here. And I got great responses from everybody who I sent it out to. One of them was a link to a video clip that I had not seen that Bill Galvin sent me that was from Roots Action. It's called A Foreign Policy Primer for Congressional Leaders. And toward the end of the session, a guy named David Swanson rattled off in response to this question what he thought would actually make for peace. And he did it so fast, I had to keep stopping the video to try and write it down and capture it. I thought it was fascinating. Here's his list. Stop arms manufacturing because, he said, I defy you to find wars around the world that don't have US-built weapons on both sides, right? 2, consistently respect the rule of law. You can't have one standard about the US invading Libya and another standard about the Russia invading Ukraine, right? 3, support cooperative initiatives. I think that's what we've been kind of focusing on and talking about. 4, democratize the UN, get rid of the veto so that you don't have countries strong-arming the entire world into a different position, right? And 4, there are just 2 more. 4, develop nonviolent cooperation skills. Look at the success that some Ukrainians have had with things like changing street signs or talking soldiers out of their neighborhoods or offering humanitarian assistance to the soldiers themselves, right? Learning how not to be occupied is another way that he put that, right? Which I love that. I love that. And then his last one was to turn back to internationalism. Like, even if we had a real conversation here in the US about what it takes to make war go away or to make for peace, that conversation doesn't work anymore in the world. If it ever did, it doesn't work now in the world in which we live. It's going to have to be an internationalist conversation. So kudos to David Swanson, wherever he is. Someday I want to meet this guy because I love his list.
Yeah.
I think he's the group World Without War. World
yes, Beyond that's War. Right. Thank you. I didn't catch his
World title. Beyond War.
And they have a book. They also have a book and an incredible website. I wanted to add too, like the thing about learn how not to be occupied. And I think the spin on that for us in the United States is how do we not be conscripted into war? We are being conscripted daily. I mean, our taxes, obviously, but the way we think about things, our framing, but we are, how do we every day, you know, this spiritual practice of not being conscripted into war, and this is the way, and to stay on the Jesus way, right?
That's a really good example. Thank you, Deb. That's great. So I guess, I'm wondering, are there examples from the civil rights era that we ought to take inspiration from? James Lawson and John Lewis and MLK, of course, and so many others that did just incredible work in the face of violence. And it wasn't just theoretical or hypothetical, it was real violence. Mm-hmm. And how they sustained that clarity of vision and commitment is just such an inspiration. So I guess I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about that or other movements that we ought to take inspiration from.
Well, I would add to that list, like the decolonization movements, whether it's India and other decolonization, which engaged like massive amounts of the population who were not armed. There may have been smaller armed groups, but majority of the population were not armed. They were of all ages and abilities. And, I think Ukrainians are doing this to some extent. And I think we are the passive ones. We are the ones who are not engaged on a global level because we feel like it's over there. It's over there, and it's not ours. But it is ours to also be engaged in a mass movement way to demilitarize ourselves as a country to change, to reverse. I mean, even to come down 10%. The military budget, they got more than they even asked for this year. The Biden administration. We've been immobilized, I think, from feeling we can fight for something different.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Deb, I really appreciate your reference to decolonization work, right? So let's remember that we have to figure out how to walk and chew gum at the same time, right? We can and should be reaching out to try and support Ukrainians fleeing the violence, Russians and Ukrainians who are pushing back against the violence in nonviolent ways. And there is work outside our door every single day that goes to the heart of structural violence in our own country. And, this is the conversation. It takes me back full circle to my conversation with the learning partners at Johnson C. Smith Theological Seminary this afternoon, right? Because what they recognize and what I learn from them every time I'm with them is that the structural violence that is the underpinning of our prison and policing industrial complex in this country is doing unbelievable harm to our own nation and to mostly BIPOC folks, Black and brown bodies, right? And what do we intend to do about it? And so, I'm really proud of the Presbyterian Peace Fellowship because we're in the middle of a discernment right now about how we kind of redefine and continue to try and deepen our understanding about the work of nonviolence. And the new vision statement we're working on is a statement that's designed to get to the heart of that question. When we think of abolition, not just the abolition that we have used historically as an organization, the abolition of war, but to actually push a step further and say, what does it mean to try and work actively for the abolition of those structures of violence upon which our entire lives are built? As you say, we're being conscripted every single day. And so, I would implore all of us to find ways to actively get involved in this, not just as a headspace, not another good book that I've read or a book study that I've done, because we need those things. I learn from those. But really, anybody who needs help, write to me or somebody from PPF, and we'll tell you how you can step right outside your door and within a mile or two, find a group of people who are doing the kind of work that we're talking about here, the decolonization work in our own communities. And that seems to me to be as important as anything else we could be doing in the long run for just for not only our security, but for the security of the whole world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So any other questions that come to mind here? I think there was one other one about structural violence that I think you kind of touched on. But the whole awareness of us being conscripted, of us being the militarism that we have absorbed is, I think, really pretty scary when you think about it, because it's so much a part of our culture. And how do we break free from that? And it seems to me that so much of it has been a spiritual practice. And that's the way that James Lawson approached it when they began meeting in that church in 1960 where was it? Nashville, I guess. I guess, do you have any final comments? Deb, please.
Yeah, I was kind of bouncing off of Leslie Vogel's comment, you know, about the huge amounts of organizing and training. And that's certainly missing, you know, right now. I'm closer friends with Reverend Phil Lawson, Reverend James Lawson's brother. And he talks about, you know, as a 14-year-old, he went to a Methodist youth conference and they were just training about nonviolence and talking about racial justice and talking about these issues. Like, that's a huge loss, you know, in the last 50 years of what's missing in terms of our denominational leadership and denominational voice. Like, where are we training youth? You know, not so much on like the catechism, but where are we training them about the issues that are key to their lives right now? Violence, mental health, climate change, and ways that they can engage with nonviolent direct action and be connected to young people all over the world and all over the country, like doing that work. That's what's missed. That's a huge piece that's missing. And I think if we're thinking about this as a long game, you know, that we have, you know, this is probably going to get, like they say, it's going to get worse, but it's going to get better, right? You know, but like our lives are really contingent. The next 30 years is, if we're still around, is going to be critical. It's like, could we invest in that and see more of that? Because I don't see another way without that generational training and investment and commitment that's rooted in these values that we're talking about and connecting those issues. You know,
it makes me smile, Deb, because now you're messing, right? I mean, now we're really talking about the heart of the church. And what does it even mean to be church at this point, right? And I'm exhausted. I honestly left my last church community a year and a half ago, and I haven't picked up another. I've been to church twice in the last year and a half on a Sunday morning, and I have no interest in joining a church, a traditional church at this point, because I'm not interested any longer in pretending that somehow our church, most of our churches, the vast majority of our churches, are playing at what it means to be faithful. And they don't actually have any interest. And you know it as soon as you walk in the door, and it becomes really obvious as soon as you first raise a conversation about the kind of things we're talking about tonight. Because the immediate response is, oh, well, you know, Pastor, you can't preach about that, or we can't do a Bible study about that because we might lose somebody, right? We might have somebody get upset enough to walk out the door, to which my response is, don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. Honestly, if we're gonna get to the heart of what's really going on here, what it means is we deconstruct the things that we have been calling church for decades, and we start over with an understanding that the heart of church is going to be small, faithful groups of people willing to support one another in getting the training necessary to do the kind of work you're talking about over the long term. And a whole lot of what passes for church now is going to have to fall apart in the process.
And it seems that that's so much more important now, given the way that our young people are not learning the history of our country. And I know I certainly wasn't being told the whole truth about the history of our country. There's so much for us to learn. And now it's become a real wedge issue. And it's important that that young people are exposed to this. And I experienced it even at a college level, university level, working with students, that they didn't know the history of the United States, about our imperialism, about the wars and interventions around the world. So, well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. I know that we've about run out of time. Thank you all for your wonderful work. Deb, thank you. Rick, this is just so wonderful and important. I hope this will be a continuing conversation for all of us, because this is so important for the church, for our spiritual lives, and our communities, and even our country. So blessings to you all.
Good night, everybody. Night. Thanks, Deb. So good to be with you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Benders of the Ark podcast, where we explore the stories of those who dare to do the hard work of social change and bending the arc of the Moore universe toward justice. Be sure to subscribe and check out more stories and interviews at bendersoftheark.com. Our music is a splendid creation of Joshua Campbell titled Sing Out, March On. So until next time, keep bending the arc of the Moore universe toward justice for creation and all of God's people.